Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.
Hi, and welcome to the final edition of Series 2 of The Political Football, a podcast series from These Football Times. Football is a global phenomenon. People who follow it can fall into an obsessive mindset where victory or defeat for their national or club team can define their lives, attitudes and understanding of the world around them, both locally and globally. Over time and in so many places around the world, though, the game's ability to intoxicate and elicit unquestioned devotion to a cause has often been manipulated by states, parties, other political organisations or indeed individuals that seek a way to persuade, influence and increase power by using football as a political tool. This series looks at examples of such scenarios, considers their context, cause and effect, and how the game has been used by such political forces, and also questions whether at times football's kickback will provide a means to counter them. This is The Political Football, and today we'll be taking a slightly different tack. We'll be looking at European academies and questioning whether they are exploitative of African talent. I'm Gary Thacker, and I'm delighted to be co-hosting this series with my good friend Stu Horsfield. How are you doing, Stu?
Hi, Gary. You okay?
Yeah, I'm quite looking forward to it.
Yeah.
So it's a slightly different tactic, as I mentioned, from the usual approach.
Yeah. Like you said, I'm looking. It is slightly different, but obviously, I'm sure as we'll go along, I'm sure there'll be plenty of political intrigue as we go along, as there always seems to be.
Yeah, definitely. So who's our guest today, mate?
So our guest today is Ryan Huttall. Ryan is an American soccer coach and a future law student, which might be good depending on what we say and don't say, from Chicago, with a particular interest in tonight's subject, obviously, and that's obviously thanks to his academic background.
Yeah, how are you all doing? So,
welcome on board.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You okay, Ryan?
Yeah, excited. Excellent. To talk about this.
Good, yeah, me too.
That's great. I mean, Roy was with us in the first series, but it's great to have him back on board and look at a totally different subject. And the European Academy is with looking at African talent. So tell us a little bit about the political context and what you consider to be the main issues around football with regard to the how European academies approach developing African talent.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's pretty much impossible to look at any facet of modern African life without kind of talking about or acknowledging the background of European intervention and exploitation on the continent. So I think what we're seeing now is just kind of maybe another, we're seeing these sort of colonial overtones still sticking around in African football.
Yeah. Okay. So it seems like what you're certain is that European or other first world countries with academies or sort of like asset stripping like they did with perhaps the raw materials of the continent previously and exploited for financial gain. And that's a continuing form of colonialism. Is that sort of the approach you're trying to put forward?
Exactly. It's pretty much developing Europe as part of the same process in which Africa is underdeveloped.
Right. Stu?
Yeah, like I say, it's going to be interesting, this one, because I'm assuming as we go along, we're going to be chatting about, you know, whether or not, you know, African football, you know, is in a position to, and like I say, I don't mean to say the wrong thing, but, you know, is it going to be essential for the development of these young African footballers, whereby it's actually an inevitable process, or whether or not, you know, were these talented young footballers allowed to stay, would there be more investment in African football? Would we see more success on a global scale of African football and thereby reducing this necessity to lose even potential talent at such a young age?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much the heart of this issue. So it's definitely not an easy topic to really get into, and I think that's why it's something that hasn't been talked a lot about.
Yeah, I guess it's that there's a thin line. It depends which it often depends which side of that line you stand on when you decide whether it's a matter of exploitation or it's a matter of development. And you know, without first world academies and the clubs, would African football talents have the chance to be as prosperous and as successful as it is. I mean, I'm not talking about the clubs, I'm talking about individual players who, and we can all name, you know, off the top of our heads, a dozen or so top international players who've come from Africa but developed through European academies. So, as I say, it's probably a case that it's depends which side of the line you stand on, whether you consider it exploitation or development. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that, Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, yeah, once again, there's this fine line that you have to kind of tread upon. But at the same time, it's not so much the individual development of these players as kind of the structural systems that we put in, that are in place in Africa to develop these players. So right now, maybe what we have in, we have young players from other regions of the world. I mean, in the U.S., we have Tyler Adams, and he was developed for the goal of winning MLS Cup. I mean, Australia, Daniel Arzani's A-League player of the season, Lautaro Martinez in racing. I mean, all of these players were developed for the sole purpose of enriching their clubs. And true. What we have in, and do we have that in Africa? And for me, I don't think we do.
Yeah, that's true. So what's your political particular interest in this? Stu mentioned about your academic work. So what is your particular interest in this?
You know, I studied a lot of African history when I was in college, but it's just kind of, it's just such an interesting topic that I don't have, like, maybe it's so much of a personal background in it. It's just such, it's really, it's fascinating to me to kind of read about and talk about.
Yeah, okay, Stu?
Yeah, like we said, it's going to be a difficult one, this one, because like we say, we're sort of torn between this necessity in terms of, you know, if we're going to give these young footballers, you know, a chance to become the very best that they can be. In terms of how it works then, Ryan, because obviously, you know, you're gonna probably certainly know better than me. Obviously, I can't speak for Gary, but in terms of, you know, you talk about this exploitation. But I mean, you know, can you sort of give us any examples whereby, you know, maybe players have gone before they should have gone? You know, is it a case of players being taken almost too young, do you think, or is it a European or first world countries waiting until they see real signs of potential before they go across and, you know, and bring the player back to their club? How is it actually operating from your perspective?
Well, I think it's obviously different in all these individual cases, but what the major fact is, in Africa, the average age for a player transfer abroad is 19. And that's by far the lowest out of any other continent. So I know it's kind of like an often racist stereotype to describe African players as raw, but a lot of the time the truth isn't that they're exactly raw in any pseudoscientific claims, but they're just really raw in the development process. They're still growing up. I mean, these are 19-year-old kids that are brought in from a continent to a new place where they often have, I mean, they literally have no idea what anything is like there.
Yeah, there's always been, I remember from my sort of economic studies, that there's always a difference between development of and development in African countries. Well, African countries, but it's a lot of third world countries, they're ex-colonial countries, and it sounds like this is a good example of that, and perhaps the academies are just another example of uneven development by the post-colonial powers.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so let's have a sort of move it on a little bit, and let's explore some, as Stu said, some examples. And you know, I mentioned we've got any football fan of almost across the world in any of the major footballing countries will have knowledge of exceptional African footballs. Perhaps someone like, let's give me an example. I'm a Chelsea fan, so Didier Drogba was the first guy that comes to my mind, and I know he sort of was taken from, he moved from Cote d'Ivoire to France because of family issues, and that wasn't an exploitation. He didn't move there because of the academy, but the academy he started playing with did develop him from there. So perhaps there is a beneficial effect to them in some cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there definitely are, it can be beneficial for some players. I mean, yeah, it's like, I mean, I don't know how much you know about, like, the charter school argument in the U.S., but it's pretty much like, we're going to improve a few players, a few students, whatever, we're going to make this kind of a way out. And, yeah, it's going to improve a few, but unless you change the actual structure, you're not really doing anything. you're just showcasing these examples as, look how much we're doing, look how much we're helping.
Yeah, it's the posting of the exceptional rather than the general.
Exactly.
Yeah. Stu?
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite interested in that. I mean, obviously, I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, but in terms of, obviously, we're looking at it from a very Eurocentric perspective here, but in terms of, from an African perspective, I mean, I'm assuming, and again, I don't mean to stereotype, but, you know, I'm assuming there's a real drive for young African footballers to be brought across to European clubs and to some of the big clubs. But in terms of the African clubs, is it for them a needs must in order to survive, or is there a real drive by maybe the African clubs to try and protect these younger players, to try and protect this asset stripping? Like you say, I mean, at 19 years old, they're only just adults. So is there a within Africa and within African clubs or African FAs or even the Continental Federation, is there a drive to protect their assets, or is it very much we need to move these players on if our club is to survive, if we can facilitate a fee or monetary compensation, to help our club develop? I'm just interested on the African perspective of what we're talking about.
Yeah, and it's not really one I can speak to, but there definitely are so many structural problems in place within African football, where the ownership is sometimes a little suspect. I mean, there's a lot of things that FIFA is not doing to kind of just give African football a stable base to build off of. So this is why these players have to be sold at a young age. And this is why, I mean, a lot of these academies and teams, they have groups of private investors that are funding them. And just compared to academies all across the world, that doesn't happen. But the only reason that's able to happen is because there's not really this ground base, and FIFA isn't doing enough for the African domestic game. So these investors are able to come in and do a lot and sell these players for nothing.
So do you think, sorry, Gary. So do you think this is more the blame maybe lies, I suppose, that they put a lot of blame at the feet of FIFA, to be fair. But, is this the sort of the world governing body not doing enough to protect football within, one of its continents?
Yeah, I mean, FIFA obviously doesn't do enough, but I think this once again goes back to just, I mean, you really cannot separate football from just the colonial exploitation of Africa since Europeans have been in Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same structures, it's the same economic issues, these are all connected.
Yeah, I guess the other issue, and I'm not sure how the financial situation works, but it strikes me that the overwhelming financial benefit will accrue to the first world country rather than Africa. Any fee paid for transfer would be, at the 19-year-old stage, would be fairly marginal compared to the potential value they could accumulate afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned academy. So if we can talk a little bit in particular about academies, and I know you sort of mentioned when we were talking the pod about Qatar's Aspire Academy. So for people who are not aware, can you give us a little bit of background around that sort of thing?
Yeah, so Qatar's Aspire Academy is a project that Qatar started on about a few years ago to bring in African players at a young age, have them developed in Qatar, and eventually naturalize them as citizens. And it's extremely illegal.
Yeah. Didn't Qatar win the Asian Cup recently? Was there a number of those players involved in that team? Would you know? I mean, I don't know. I understand it. Just struck me as you were saying that then.
No, actually, I don't know. That's a really good question.
But I guess, they were fairly unfancied. And they didn't have a great deal of history of success in that competition. It might well be the case that they're, and perhaps it's something that I might take a look at after we've finished. You mentioned about FIFA earlier, and I think there's a particular article in their constitution, Article 19, that's supposed to deal with these sort of things. Perhaps it's more in the discussion than in the reality.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that as a Chelsea fan, you know all about Article 19.
The appeal's going on to the Court of Arbitration Sport in Switzerland, and I'm fully confident we will be cleared of all the charges and be given apologies and a box of chocolates.
I had to throw that in there.
Oh, it's okay. I'm used to it. Can you explain to the listeners what Article 19 means, what it's supposed to do?
Yeah, so what Article 19 is supposed to do is protect youth players from being transferred abroad for the purpose of just protecting them and allowing them to grow and develop as people, because obviously it's not a very good thing for young teenagers to be transferred away from their parents and all these things. And by and large, FIFA, I mean, they kind of enforce it, they kind of don't. But in this Qatar case, there's just absolutely no even semblance of caring or even pretending to do anything about these players being brought in. And I mean, for a long time, a lot of these Qatari scouts and they were hiring a lot of these people that were just going into Africa and looking for really young kids. I mean, I think one of the qualifications was we can't bring players in over the age of 13. So they're going to find young, like, kids and teenagers and trying to develop them in Qatar.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's important that we mentioned, we should state here, that we're not suggesting that anybody from Qatar's Aspire Academy or anybody else is breaking any particular laws. We're just examining the sort of situation as we understand it. It's probably worth mentioning that as we go along. So, let's do it.
Yeah. I'm not sure how we've not been sued yet, Gary, the way we carry on.
Lawyers don't listen to us.
To be fair, that's probably it. It's a good job, to be fair. It's really interesting what you say. I mean, especially the blatant disregard for, as you call it, Article 19, and it's almost brazen in the way these things are done and the way this process is carried out. And I suppose, like we said, we look at FIFA and their sort of moral obligation. I know we've touched on FIFA at the end of Series 1, didn't we? Beginning of this one, we looked at FIFA and we looked at, FIFA's almost, not turning a blind eye, but almost, if it suits their need or their political gain or their development, then they're quite happy to, to turn a blind eye as such. And I suppose you wonder really where this practice, this code of practice will end. If we're talking about players, 13 years old, where will it end? Where will it, do the barriers just keep getting pushed? Do the rules just keep getting, become more and more blurred between sort of the two parties who are trying to, develop these footballers? But I suppose, unfortunately, when all said and done, this comes down to money, and it's always going to come down to money. If you have a potentially poorer continent or a poorer football infrastructure, money will always be the motivating factor, regardless of what the moral ethics of it are. Unfortunately, money will always talk, and so. Because I've just been making some notes as we've been chatting here, and again, Ryan might know this better, but has there ever been a, what am I trying to say here? This, if football or if FIFA are really interested in developing football in Africa, what about bringing development centres into Africa? So, is the potential for clubs, I mean, I don't know, someone like Manchester City, for example, is there a potential there for maybe them to bring almost like a satellite academy, if you like, into Africa, where maybe these potential African talent could be harnessed and developed at least within their own continent? Obviously, you couldn't have them all in every single African nation, but maybe if you could have them, just one within the continent, whereby at least some of these young players could stay within the continent longer, if you like. But I don't know, Ryan, I don't know what you think, whether that's potential or whether European clubs just want to bring them across and away.
I mean, I think that's the exact problem, is if a club like Manchester City goes to Africa, builds an academy in Africa, keeps these kids in Africa, and then holds their rights. That's the issue for me. I think that what FIFA needs to be doing is really doing a lot with the structural at the structural level of these clubs, where the academies aren't producing players for Manchester City. They're producing players for African clubs.
But is that realistically ever going to happen?
That's a good question, but it's realistically never going to happen now, because there's just so much of financial benefit for these investors and these clubs to come in. I mean, there'd have to be a drastic series of changes. You'd have to do so many. There's so many like problems just with what is in place now with the academies. There's for profit and private academies. These academies aren't really holistic centers for education. They're all about they're all about just producing players. So this is not going to happen. But we can hope.
Yeah, I agree. Morally, you're absolutely right. Morally, there should be, and ethically, you know, this development of African footballers should be for the benefit of Africa and African clubs. I fully agree and fully support that.
There are things that we can do, though.
Okay.
And for one, for-profit academies, where for-profit academies can just FIFA can get rid of those.
Okay.
And then I think FIFA can do a lot more with kind of restricting access to foreign clubs coming in and taking over African academies.
Okay.
But it's wild to think that. We think that, yes, it's a money issue, but this is also happening in the United States, which is the richest country in the world. I mean, Bayern has academies here. There are things that, I don't know. That's why I don't know if it's necessarily completely economically based.
I'd say that's an interesting one, because we've done these a dozen or so of, perhaps a bit more than that, of these pods now, and one of the questions that tends to crop up is that what type of politics is involved? Is it financial? Is it power politics? Is it personal politics? Is it just a matter of control? And this is almost definitely defined in a box sealed and tied with a ribbon. This is all about finance and money. But you said it's not necessarily all about finance. So I'm just looking at what aspects aren't money related, Ryan?
I mean, obviously everything definitely is related to money. But I think one of the maybe kind of a line we could draw is we think about so when we think about Article 19 and we think about some illegal transfers that have happened from of the bigger clubs. I mean, Barcelona were in trouble for signing a South Korean player, and that one was one that got them flagged down. But they're not really celebrating this transfer, whereas I mean, when Qatar was doing this Right to Dream Academy, they were literally like marketing this as we're giving these players a way out of the continent.
So when you
do that, and when it becomes a way out, it pretty much reduces Africa to a subjected role, which yes. I think there's not sometimes that's a little racially based rather than purely about the money.
Yeah, that's an absolutely fair comment. Absolutely fair comment. I just want to draw your attention to an example of one of these for-profit academies in Africa, and there's one in Ivory Coast, I believe. Is it Mimos?
Yeah, the Mimos CIFCOM Academy.
Yeah. So, can you just tell listeners a little bit about that and how that sort of fits into that sort of profile that you described earlier?
Yeah. So it's not so much, I don't know if it's necessarily a for-profit academy, but it's definitely an academy built to sell players rather than to produce players for the domestic team. And it's definitely, I mean, it's a fantastic academy. It's produced Aboué, Salomon Kalou, Boubacar Barry, Kolo and Yaya Toure. But when you look at the way this academy is run, one of the first things that they do is when they were built, is they kind of built all these relationships with European clubs and with scouts, and that definitely takes away from the purpose of an academy. I mean, you'd think the purpose of an academy would be to develop these players, but when you build it right away and then your first order of business instead of developing players is producing relationships with clubs, there's definitely something wrong there.
Yeah, I guess it almost has the feel of a factory about it, doesn't it? You know, you're putting the raw material in one end and getting a sellable product out the other.
Yeah, which is just African colonialism in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Steve?
It's funny, just listening there to that one, and obviously you mentioned Didier Drogba earlier, Gary, and I wanted to ask Ryan, in terms of established African footballers, and you know, like you said, we can name plenty of them, but certainly someone like Didier Drogba, who to me comes across as very not so much political, but very much about, you know, where he comes from. He's all about giving back to the community. He's all about giving back to his, you know, his nation of birth. And I'm wondering, what do the established, you know, the players who've been there and done it, the players who are coming to the end of their career, how, you know, what are they doing in terms of supporting this retainment of African talent?
You know, I don't know enough about that. I think Drogba was involved in building an academy in Africa, and I think a lot of these players are involved in trying to make academies more holistic and more about education and building people rather than players. But when you have just individuals coming in to do this, you're not going to be able to achieve anything on a structural basis. You're just going to be able to help a few more players out.
All I was going to say was I'm just wondering whether the voice of, you know, like Gary said, you know, we've done loads of these now, you know, and we often talk about, you know, political footballers and which ones have a political voice, and you know, are they tended to be listened to, you know, perhaps more than a politician, if you like, or certainly a FIFA delegate, and I just wondered whether the weight of support of someone like Didier Drogba would maybe have more impact and more effect, I suppose is all I was wondering, really.
I'm sure it would help, but Didier Drogba is also one of the players that was produced through one of these academies. So I think to really have a player that would be able to kind of exploit the structural flaws, you'd need a player that didn't make it through one of these academies, but that would never happen.
Yeah. Moji, I guess there's nobody sort of more zealous than somebody who's been through its experience and saw the flaws. Because I mean, Didier Drogba is a good example of political influence in the football in Africa. So he and the national team helped to bring an end to the civil war in Cote d'Ivoire. And obviously, you've got people like George Weah, who'd become prime minister of his country. Is it prime minister or president? I'm not sure, but certainly succeeded politically there. So I think there is sort of a potential there for players to become famous to perhaps have a potential beneficial effect. But the question I was going to ask you about, particularly with regard to the academies in Africa, do they have any beneficial effect on the game domestically in Africa? So I know players are produced for and sold to European clubs, but do they also benefit domestic African football, would you know?
I mean, I don't know how much. I mean, they do. A lot of these players are produced, and a lot of them become like African domestic players, and they play in continental competition. And that's obviously beneficial. And then, I mean, just having players like Drogba and Gervinho and Abue on an international stage is a massive source of pride for the country, and I'm sure it inspires a lot of young players. So these things do good, and that's not the point. Isn't that they necessarily aren't good things? It's just that they're producing individuals rather than really doing anything on a structural level to change African football.
Sure, Steve.
Yeah, I'm really sorry, Ryan. I just seem to have loads of questions. I feel your indignance at what's happening, and I fully agree and I'm fully supporting it. I'm kind of trying to think of ways that I can change it. Although I'm not sure how successful I'm going to be. But again, if I suppose, you know, African, because obviously, you know, if we look at South America and we look at, you know, again, young talent coming over to Europe from South America, I'm fully aware that, you know, South Africa is a far more established footballing continent, and you know, and has a very strong domestic league and a very strong setup, and is very well supported by FIFA. But I suppose if you know, what I'm asking here is if domestic African football was better, had more investment, was stronger, do you think the players would be more inclined to play, or are you almost fighting a battle that actually young African footballers don't really want you to fight?
I mean, it's pretty much, if you incentivize African football, no one's not going to want to play for their hometown team. I think the issue is that we use Africa, when football at least like reduces Africa to a subjected role, where the dream isn't to grow up and play for your home club, it's to grow up and play for Real Madrid, and that's fine. But I think that the way that these academies are set up isn't to produce players for the first team, and that's the major issue for me.
Yeah, I just want to sort of give you sort of a comparative scenario here. So, is there that much difference between academies tapping into African talent than academies tapping into the poorer regions of South America, talents of South America, or the poorer regions of Europe, for that matter, as well? Is it just a case of general exploitation, and Africa's just an example of what's going on across the globe in the greater or lesser extent in different areas as well?
Yeah, I mean, these things are happening all over the world. I mean, even you look at the U.S., Tyler Adams was sold for $3 million. Now he's starting for RB Leipzig. I mean, these teams are able to do this because this is a weaker area. I mean, and the financial incentives aren't as strong here. So smart clubs are going to do that. I think the issue is that there is no established base in Africa for this to even really be improving these domestic clubs. I mean, and when a European club comes into South America and buys a young player who's been playing in front of 60,000 fans, then that money goes into the club. The club uses that money to develop more players. It helps South American football. When a club like Manchester City goes into Africa, buys a player for nothing, and then brings him over to their academy, that fee doesn't necessarily help the African first team.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely, it does. I agree that is exactly the situation, but I just wanted to sort of tease out the difference between the structural setup in these academies in Africa as to other parts of the world. But you put that out nicely, Steve.
Yeah. Again, looking at it from a political point of view, I mean, we look at, you know, the president of the African Football Federation, and I mean, how vocal are they in terms of repelling sort of the advances of UEFA and clubs, you know, within UEFA? Because it's almost it seems to me like a conflict of confederations here. You have a very strong, well-established confederation whose clubs are, like you say, coming along and almost just stealing, if you like, from another confederation. But I wonder, from a almost like a political sense, you know, what the president of the African Football Federation is actually doing in order to either try and stop this or to at least engage in some sort of improved recompense, or try and, you know, create, you know, look at UEFA and ask them for a little bit more support in terms of developing football within their federation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't exactly know. It's a lot of that isn't like really open information on what these African leaders are doing, but I think just kind of one of the I don't know. I think it's tough because a lot of these African like federation presidents see these players doing well on a global stage and think that this is the end game.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, we sort of touched on this earlier. I think Stu mentioned this, that the only way this could possibly be ended is by FIFA acting, and so you might not know the answer, but I'll be interested to hear your opinion on this. So, if FIFA had the will to end this, to change this, could they? And if they could, why won't they?
it's tough. I mean, we talked about this a little bit earlier, and FIFA don't really have an incentive. I mean, I'm sure a lot of these investors and these academies are tied up within FIFA, and there's really not much incentive for FIFA to really do anything to improve the African continental game. I mean, the only way for it really to happen would be to get rid of a lot of these private academies, maybe do a little bit more to protect African youth players, but it's definitely going to take a cultural shift towards African youth players recognizing that to get rid of this notion that you can't find success in the continent.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And this is something that the United States is going through right now as well.
Yeah.
And you've seen the massive shift to a lot of these players, like, really becoming involved in their clubs and wanting to become homegrown players rather than leaving at the first sign. So it's definitely possible. It's just going to be a lot harder because we've seen how hard it is in the U.S. and soccer's so ingrained in the culture. It's such a big money business, and it's taken so long. So to do it in Africa would be a lot harder.
Yeah, you mentioned about players, young African players, don't want to necessarily play for local clubs. They want to play for Real Madrid or whatever. And a couple of episodes ago, Stu and I were talking to Uri Levy, and we talked about Egypt. And he was saying there, the players there, he described it as football for dreamers because all the players there dream of getting a big move to continental Europe and playing for Real Madrid, AC Milan, Lazio, Bayern Munich, or wherever the big clubs are. And a lot of players in Egypt have even adopted nicknames, sort of Europeanized nicknames of famous players. Like there's a guy called Trezeguet. There's a guy called Medved. So they've dropped these nicknames almost as a sort of a tag to the European game. So it absolutely meshes it with precisely what you described earlier, that the players in Africa, the dream is to play for the big European. And I suppose, you know, from their point of view, it's where the money is, and that's, you know, that's where we all go to work in the foreign analysis.
Yeah, I mean, it makes complete sense. We all want to play for the biggest clubs and be the best.
Yeah, Stu?
Yeah, it's funny because obviously when you talk about America, I think where the disadvantage lies for Africa, and certainly you will definitely know better than I do in this, right? Obviously, America has its, you know, its four main sports, whereas, you know, I suppose in Africa, you know, football is the number one sport, and it is the one route out, isn't it? It's the one sport where a lot of money can be made for an individual or for their family or for whoever it is. You know, America, certainly from my perspective, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but football seems to be very much, you know, in the minority when you compare it with baseball, basketball, hockey, and the NFL. And I just wonder whether America, I suppose I'm asking you, Ryan, whether America is quite so concerned of the asset stripping in football than if it was their baseball players or their NFL players or their basketball players.
Yeah, I mean, if LeBron James was being scouted by Real Madrid tried to bring LeBron James in his prime, there'd be massive uproar here.
Because as well, I would assume that, I suppose if we use the Lakers then for our example, I suppose the Lakers can almost cherry pick the very best basketballers at Eastern Europe or wherever they may lie and bring them across to the NBA, which is almost what we're talking about here, but in reverse, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's true.
And I just think that for Africa, it's very much, it doesn't have that. It doesn't have anything else. You know, it is football. Everything for them is all about football. The way out, you know, it is through football. There is no other route in terms of professional sport that can bring the riches and the rewards that football can. So, you know, you are fighting against that as well, aren't you? With the idea of morally trying to make this better, trying to, you know, protect these young players from, I suppose, from the hands of European clubs, but when it is the only option for them, it makes that struggle even harder.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true.
It's interesting. I'm donning a Marxist hat for a few seconds. The capitalist system is all about exploitation. You know, profit is defined as exploitation. It's the difference between the cost and the sell. And I guess in a capitalist system, this process we're describing, this structural situation of the academies, the European academies taking African talent, or talent from anywhere, it doesn't really matter, but we're talking about Africa particularly now, is just a natural byproducts of the capitalist system. And football is less a sport than a business now, no matter how much we might want to argue to the contrary, or believe to the contrary, or hope to the contrary. That's almost certainly true now, and I think it's probably just something we need to understand, that it's going to be, as you said, Ryan, very difficult for people to change those things, because that's just the way of the world in the capitalist system.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. A major tenet of the capitalist system is unfair colonial system, economic systems. So,
it's domination, exploitation.
Exactly. So this is once again what it all comes back to.
Yeah. Stu?
Yeah. It's again. I don't keep coming back to past examples, but I mean, it's funny because Stephen and I, you know, talked about, you know, we discussed FIFA, and we talked about how when Havelange was elected as FIFA president, you know, Stanley Rouse, and the whole shift from FIFA in 74 came about through Stanley Rouse. You know, the English president of FIFA at the time was very much of colonial mindset. He was very much that Africa was very grateful for everything that Stanley Rouse had given to them through FIFA, whereas Havelange was a lot more politically astute and saw with the one member, one vote system that actually, if he could harness the African votes, if he could improve the experience of African football, then he would be able to, you know, to take those votes and would be able to become FIFA president, which he did, you know, for a long period and to a very successful end, and was FIFA president for 24 years and was consistently supported by the African continent because of what he promised them, extra places at the World Cup, you know, competition. He would introduce new competitions, but these competitions would be held on the African continent. So a lot of promise was made by FIFA through Havelange and again through Blatter as well, because of the African potential with its 50-odd member states to be able to almost elect a president. But it seems to me that, again, you know, the president promises a lot and delivers little, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely makes sense.
You know, sorry, go on, Ryan.
Yeah. No, yeah, that totally makes sense. I'm just thinking kind of an example right now, and I know I keep bringing this back to American soccer, because that's where my background is, but you look at kind of where American soccer was 10 years ago, and the kind of the global game wasn't necessarily too interested in American investment and doing all this. And then now look at what all these kind of academies have produced by once, like, they've kind of incentivized producing their own players rather than European clubs producing it. And all these fantastic young American players are now being produced by academies because we've incentivized development here. Whereas in Africa, I think that's something that FIFA could do. If FIFA really prioritized African academies, they'd be producing so many more players than kind of just the few that slip through. Does that make sense?
I absolutely agree with you. I mean, if you look at the size of, you know, the continent of Africa, that there must be so much untapped potential, but like you say, Ryan, you know, the minute that potential is unearthed, or you find that player who just elevates themselves just above the norm, mm-hmm. they're gonna be gone, you know, almost instantly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and there's no incentive to really create a strong Africa because it's just gonna make players more expensive.
Yeah, can I ask you an impossible question, Ryan?
Go for it.
Do it, Gary. Do it.
Many years ago, probably the best part of 25 years ago now, Pelé said that an African country would win the World Cup before the turn of the century. No, they haven't. But African football, national and in the international stage, has moved on a bit. So Would you say that this situation of the European academies developing or exploiting, depending on which side of the line you sit, African talent has made that more or less likely?
Can you repeat that one more time?
Yeah, so
basically, give me more time to think about it.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So I'll rephrase it. So basically, okay. You know, we talk about players being developed and potentially improved or exploited to be improved, but is there a benefit for African football on the international stage? Is basically the genesis of the question I'm looking at. So because they're making players, they're producing better African players, do African countries, are they got a better chance to excel in the world stage? So, for instance, let's give some examples. So, Carnage have won the South African World Cup. Cote d'Ivoire have been quite strong in international tournaments as well. So, is it less? Does this academy system make it more or less likely that African national sides, so be Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria, Ghana, or South Africa, or wherever, or in North Africa, Egypt, Morocco, Algeria? Is it likely to make them stronger or weaker, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, the more players you're producing and the more players that you're investing in, it's going to help the national team. But I think, once again, you're doing 5% of what could actually be done.
That's exactly the point I'm making. This is what I thought you were going to say. So it is doing some good, but a different system would do so much more good on the whole.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, exactly.
Yeah,
and just like use this little bit of potential and see like how much it could be rather than looking at it and saying, wow, like we're really happy we have that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd agree on the fact, as we mentioned earlier, that, you know, we could all mention a dozen, 15, 20 top-notch African players and say, yeah, African players doing really well. But that's the exception. It's not the rule. And there's so much talent there that isn't being developed because of the concentration that where they can make the money by selling on these small number of players through these academies. So, yeah, I absolutely agree with what you said. Stu?
Yeah, it's funny. Ryan mentioned earlier about how it's not, you know, an African player's dream to play for their hometown team, perhaps so much as it, you know, as it is to go and play for Real Madrid. And I suppose you get the impression that maybe, you know, African footballers, actually, their dream is to represent their nation at a World Cup and, you know, and put it on a world stage. So, you know, it's almost like that hometown representation stage is completely missed out. And it goes from these academies to coming back and representing their nation, you know, the World Cup or the African Cup of Nations, you know, and it's like club football level with Africa is actually just missed out. And maybe that's why, you know, you only have this select handful of actual players rather than what should be in theory. You know, if we use America as the example with 200 odd million mm-hmm. population, but yet they're competing against four other major sports. In Africa, the population is whatever the population is, but it's all about one sport, and you're right, through the just the sheer mathematics of it all, there should be so many more better players than there actually is.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it.
But it just seems to me that, you know, African footballers seem to almost prize coming back home. You know, you look at Mo Salah for Egypt, that coming mm-hmm. back home to Egypt, not coming back home to the hometown club or the town where they were, but it's almost coming back home to a country, and the whole country gets behind these players rather than the home team. And it seems to be that, I'm not saying that seems to be what Africa has settled for, but that it's almost like, I suppose, a compromise, if you like, whereby, mm-hmm. and certainly the Ivory Coast, you know, is another great example, you know, produced a lot of talented footballers who are very much celebrated, you know, at the, you know, the African Cup of Nations or the World Cup, and it just seems to be more of a collective thing rather than a provincial hometown pride within each individual country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly it. And to get that kind of you just need they need to really incentivize the African club game.
I guess the problem there though is what Stu has just accurately described is what the system allows, is what the system produces, what the system dictates, and the only way to change that is for, as you say, incentivize the success of the African clubs, which requires money, and the ability to compete with top European clubs is like a non-league club trying to compete with Manchester United. The money just isn't there. And I saw a thing in the news. I think it was this week. It might have been a tail end of last week. That I'm still not convinced. I'm not sure that it wasn't a kind of hype, a joke. A picture of a team lineup of supposedly the Manchester City under fives academy team. I'm still not sure it's true. No, perhaps it is, and perhaps it isn't. I don't know, but. I mean, talk about taking kids early. I mean, you were saying about, the average age of African transfers is 19. I mean, I don't know about coaching. I don't know how you could possibly know the talent of a kid under five. Who am I, Man City, know far more than I do about that sort of thing. But if that isn't sort of, catching them early, I mean, they'll be signing fetuses soon. I mean, it's just...
We do that in the US too.
Under fives?
Not like obviously don't sign into a team. I think the teams start at seven, but yeah, there's programs where we have. I mean, I work for the Rapids, which is the pro team in Denver, and we have programs for 4-year-olds.
Wow.
And it's definitely with an eye to getting them into the system.
Yeah, well, I mean, okay.
It's ridiculous, but this, when I saw that, it's not really that surprising. I think the surprising thing is that maybe they're competing together as a team. That is surprising.
Yeah,
but I'm pretty sure every club has systems in place for.
Well, I mean, getting kids involved at the club is one thing. I mean, getting them involved in playing and coming, turn up and enjoying playing and just seeing how they go is one thing. But having and perhaps this isn't, and perhaps I've just sort of taken it on the wrong hook. And if I have, I apologise. But to have an academy under five teams,
it's a little ridiculous.
It feels it. I mean, I don't know if you do, from somebody of my age and generation, it just feels a little bit out there somewhere. I'm not sure where, but it's somewhere out there.
I'm with you, Gary. But it must be a generational thing.
Absolutely.
I can't even begin to imagine. I love football. I've played it all my life. I can't even begin to imagine myself in any form of structured environment at 5 years old.
It's chaos.
But yeah, I'm sure. Just one thing, Ryan, and again, we just seem to be asking you impossible questions. I am really sorry.
I'm very much enjoying this. So,
in terms of, we talk about these young players at 19, and I suppose two things, really. One is how much responsibility do clubs take for the players' welfare when they bring them over, how much support are additional family members brought across, what support is in place for those very young African footballers. And I suppose my second question is the return rate or the failure rate or the dropout rate of players who don't make it, can't cope, homesickness, and are just returned, I suppose, back to where they were, if you like. And I suppose I'm just interested in how much care that the European clubs take of these, very valuable but also very delicate players that they're, assets that they're bringing across. And it's awful to talk about a human being as an asset. I am aware of that. But essentially, that's what they are. But I just wonder how much care the club take of them and, if it doesn't work out, what's in place, when they return back to, back home.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very serious issue, and it's one thing to have these systems in place in clubs like Barcelona and Manchester City, where these players obviously are taken care of, and they realize that these players are investments. But I think, you can go read hundreds of articles online about some of these small Ukrainian teams, Lithuanian, Latvian, it's a lot of these kind of smaller clubs that really just bring these players over and do nothing to take care of them. So you're putting African players in apartment buildings at 18, sometimes without their parents, actually a lot of the time without their parents, and you're setting these players up to fail. And this happens so frequently, and it's a real, there is a real issue with trafficking, in player trafficking.
Yeah, that's frightening.
Yeah, I mean, I can even give an example. I grew up playing in Chicago, and the Chicago Fire Academy brought in 5 African players that were teenagers and put them in an apartment, and one of them was shot and killed. And this happens all over the world.
Yeah. It is, like I say, we've talked about this asset stripping and the ethics and the morals behind it, but, you know, if European clubs are going to go and do this, you know, there has to be that moral responsibility to then look after for as long as they are with you. And even, you know, sort of, the return journey, if it doesn't work out, if it doesn't make it, or God forbid there's an injury or whatever it is,
Yeah. There's
still that moral responsibility to return this player, but also return them, you know, in a way where, you know, they can continue with their lives, continue hopefully with their career or whatever it is as well. And like, I suppose, like you say, you know, we're sat here talking about it, and certainly for me, you know, you think Real Madrid, Ajax, Manchester City, and you're right, you know, there's teams in the Ukraine, Lithuania, and Gary also made a great point that actually it's the sell-on fee where the real money is made. And I suppose an Eastern European club is more than happy to take a gamble on the off chance that they find the next 20, 25 million pound player, and, you know, and so it goes on.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much the point of this is, if you have to view a person as an asset, you should not be bringing that player to your team.
Yeah.
It's a sobering thought, and as always, Tom's in with us on our podcasts, and always like to close the same question, Ryan, and it's a little bit sort of it doesn't quite fit with this subject, but I'm going to ask it anyway and perhaps give you sort of an idea of how I'd like to approach answering it. So I always say that, can football exist in a political vacuum, or does the passion engendered by the game too easily lend itself to being a political tool? Is the political football inevitable? So with regards to this subject, with regards to the history, colonialism, etc., does an emerging African football scene offer a potential change? Welcome voting would be to be a way to make the situation change, or is the history locking African players and their presence in academies into an exploitative relationship?
I mean, until the exploitative capitalist system in place in the world economy changes, this is never going to change.
Yeah. I'm sure you're right.
Pro-Marxism, right?
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. I mean, that's been a brilliant discussion, Ryan. I mean, it's very different from the ones we've done geographical areas. And to look at this as a different way of examining politics and football was a little refreshing. One of this is why I wanted to have this as the sort of the finale of Series 2. So massive thanks for coming on and sharing your thoughts with us.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, any final thoughts to Roy today?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I was taking a breath in. yeah, it's been great in that it seems to be it's a topic that covers old world colonial problems in a very new 21st century capitalist way. It's a real juxtaposition, if you like, of two worlds that are actually colliding, and unfortunately the victims, if you like, are these young, you know, impressionable footballers. And until you engage in discussion like this and you really sit down for an hour and chat with, you know, with other people about it, really it's only cursory thoughts that are ever given to this subject, when actually there's a massive underlying problem here that, you know, I'm sure, you know, people are well aware of, and that people are, you know, more aware of certainly than I am. But it's something that obviously needs more open discussion and needs to be looked at, if you like, even if it's just to protect these players that are coming across. But it's as always, it absolutely fascinating to listen to you, Ryan.
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Ryan.
Thanks.
It's been great. Okay, so as mentioned, this episode brings Series 2 of the Political Football to a close, and once more we've had an absolute ball producing them, and I'm hoping you've listened to them and enjoyed them too. The good news, however, well, we hope it's good news anyway, is that Series 3 has already been planned, and not too far down the road we'll be back filling your lug holes with all things political and football related. We'd like to thank all of our guests across both series so far. Simply couldn't produce the podcast without them. It's been an absolute joy sitting back and listening to these guys educate and entertain both Stu and myself with their knowledge and enthusiasm for the game we all love. So big thanks, of course, obviously, to all our listeners. Without you, we'd just be sitting here in a darkened room and talking to ourselves, and there's no fun in that. So we hope you've enjoyed the pods as much as we have. Also, I'd like to offer a monumental thanks to Stu, who's co-hosted these first two series with me, and happily has agreed to stay on board for the next series as well. As well as being my co-host, Stu also looks after all the electronic whirly gigs and jiggery power cream, the techno dinosaurs finding possible. So, massive thanks to you, Stu.
Well, like I say, I think it's more by luck than good management, Gary, but more than happy to take care of the technical side, even if it's just to jump in and have a school day every Sunday night on subjects that I actually really like rather than the ones I did at school.
Yeah, that's great. But I should mention at this stage as well that in not too distant future, Stu will be launching a series of his own alongside Steve Scragg, looking at people's favourite teams over various years and talking about their, it's called My Side. I think it's called My Side, Stu. Is it Listen to My Side?
Listen to My Side. It's working title at the moment, but it seems to be sticking at the moment, but only for the want of, I can't think of anything better yet. But yeah, Listen to My Side. Just, it's just, you know, guests coming on and talking about their most favourite side, you know, the one that evokes the most memories, the one that is a real sort of distillation, if you like, of why they love the game. And it's, you know, it's just getting them to come on. And you know, if it's a club side, it's over a single season. If it's an international side, it's, you know, it's over one particular tournament. And it's a real sort of in-depth look and discussion about that particular side and why it evokes, you know, so many memories for the guest.
Yeah, that sounds great, and you know, with yourself and Stevie hosting that, that's going to be a guaranteed win. And I'll look forward to being invited and coming as a guest and talking about my favourite team. And it looks like a winner, Stu, and you know, best luck with that, buddy.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Okay, so thanks for listening. As I said, this winds up Series 2, and we'll be setting to work over the next few weeks at lining up Series 3. So I hope you'll join us again then. So. For the time being, thank you and goodbye from the Political Football.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.